and his voice was so hoarse from shouting that he was unable to speak above a whisper. Yet he felt a profound sense of satisfaction and accomplishment to be standing at last on land, surrounded by his men. The men themselves spoke very little as they drank their milk. Each seemed absorbed in his own thoughts. Most of them were extremely unsteady, both from exhaustion and from the fact that they had fought the motion of the boat so long that their equilibrium was temporarily unbalanced. When they had finished their milk, a party was sent to bring in some seals. They brought back four, which were immediately stripped of blubber and cut into thick steaks. Green set to work frying up all the steaks his pots could hold, while the rest of the men pitched the tents and piled the stores well clear of the water. Finally, the food was ready, and they ate. It was neither breakfast, nor lunch, nor dinner. It was one long, intermittent meal. As soon as they had finished the first round of steaks, Green put more on the fire. When these were ready, the men stopped whatever they were doing and ate again. It wasn't until nearly 3 p.m. that they had eaten all they could hold. Then it was time to sleep. They unrolled their soaked sleeping bags and wrung out what water they could. The dampness that remained made little difference. James wrote, "Turned in and slept, as we had never slept before. Absolute dead, dreamless sleep, oblivious of wet sleeping bags, lulled by the croaking of the penguins." It was the same for all of them. "How delicious," wrote Hurley, "to wake in one's sleep and listen to the chanting of the penguins mingling with the music of the sea. To fall asleep and awaken again and feel this is real. We have reached the land." Most of the men were awakened once during that glorious night to stand an hour's watch, and even this was almost pleasure. The night was calm and the sky was clear. The moon shone on the little pebbled beach washed by the waves, a scene of utter tranquillity. "Furthermore," wrote Worsley, "the watchmen during their one-hour tour of duty feed themselves, keep the blubber fire going, feed themselves, dry their clothes, feed themselves, and then feed themselves again before turning in." Shackleton permitted the men to sleep until 9:30 the next morning. But at breakfast, an ugly rumour began to circulate, and when they had finished eating, Shackleton confirmed the almost shocking truth of it. They would have to move. There could hardly have been a more demoralizing prospect. Having barely escaped the sea's hungry grasp a scant 24 hours before, now to have to return to it? But the need was indisputable. They could see that only great good fortune had permitted them to land where they were. The cliffs at the head of the beach bore the marks of high tides and the scars of storm damage, indicating that the entire spit was frequently swept by seas. The place was obviously tenable only in good weather and while the tides were moderate. Shackleton ordered Wilde to take a crew of 5 seamen in the Wills and sail west along the coast to look for a more secure campsite. The Wills set out at 11 o'clock. The rest of the party worked at a leisurely pace throughout the day. The tents were struck, then pitched again, as high up on the beach as a shelf could be found that would accommodate them. The stores were piled even higher in case of a sudden storm. But most of the day was spent simply enjoying life. They were all still crippled from the 6 days spent in cramped positions in the boats, and now, for the first time, they began to realize the incredible tension they had been under for so long. They became conscious of it, strangely, by a mounting awareness of a long-forgotten feeling. It was something they knew now, but they had not really experienced since abandoning the Endurance. It was security. The knowledge that, comparatively at least, there was nothing to fear. There was still danger, of course, but it was different from the imminent threat of disaster which had stalked them for so long. In a very literal way, it seemed to release a portion of their minds which hitherto had been obsessed with the need to remain ceaselessly alert. It was a joy, for example, to watch the birds, simply as birds, and not for the significance they might have, whether they were a sign of good or evil, an opening of the pack, or a gathering storm. The island itself was a sight worthy of more than casual observation. Along the coastline, the cliffs looked like an enormous wall thrown up against the sea. Glaciers crept down their sides all the way to the water, where the action of the waves constantly wore away at the ice. Now and again, a small piece or a section almost as big as a berg would plunge into the water. The ferocity of the land apparently spawned similarly forbidding weather. For some strange meteorological reason, savage tornado-like downdrafts periodically swooped down from the heights above and fairly exploded when they struck the water, whipping the seas close inshore into a frenzy of spindrift and froth. Hussey thought they were the Willywars, sudden bursts of wind peculiar to coastal areas and polar regions. It was one of these, apparently, that had nearly caught the docker the morning before. They waited throughout the day for Wilde and his party to return. But darkness came, and there were still no signs of them. The other men ate supper and turned in, leaving the blubber stove burning with the door of the firebox open and facing seaward to act as a beacon. Hardly had they fallen asleep when the watchman heard a shout from seaward. It was the returning Wills. All hands were roused, and they went down to the water's edge. Wilde brought the Wills through the breakers, and she was soon hauled well up onto the beach. Wilde and his five exhausted men confirmed the fact that this was truly an inhospitable place. In 9 hours of looking, they had found only one seemingly secure place to camp, a fairly sheltered spit of beach, about 150 yards long and 30 yards wide, some 7 miles along the coast to the west. There was a good-sized penguin rookery there, Wilde said, and his men had also sighted a number of seals and some few sea elephants. A nearby glacier would keep them supplied with ice for melting into water. Shackleton was satisfied, and he announced that they would break camp at dawn. The party was awakened at 5 a.m., and they ate their breakfast in the light from the blubber stove. When dawn came, it was clear and still. The boats were launched, and everything was loaded, except 10 cases of sledging rations and some paraffin, which were left behind in a very high crevice to minimize the weight in the boats. The supplies could be sent for later if the need arose. The tide came in very slowly, so it wasn't until 11 o'clock that there was enough water over the reef to get away. The Wills had been lightened by transferring Blackborough to the Caird and Hudson to the docker, and for the first 2 miles the boats made fair progress. Then, with hardly an instant's warning, the elements seemed to go berserk. All at once the wind was shrieking in their ears, and the sea, which a moment before had been nearly calm, was torn into froth. They were caught in one of the violent downdrafts from the cliffs. It only lasted 3 or 4 terrifying minutes, and then was gone. But it heralded a change in weather, for within a quarter hour the wind had moved from the south to the southwest, and quickly risen in force from breeze to gale to storm, then hurricane. The boats under the lee of the land should have been protected from the gale by the towering 2,000-foot cliffs alongside them. But instead, the cliffs sucked down on winds passing overhead, so that they shrieked down upon the boats and roared out to sea. Only by staying very close up against the land could the boats avoid being blown offshore. To port, the land rose so sheer that it looked as if it were hanging over them. Great drunken green waves were flung against the cliffs, and spray filled the air. To starboard, the sea was whipped into a maelstrom by the wind. Between, there was a meagre corridor of safety, and along this passage the boats crept forward, and their progress was creeping at best. Shortly after noon, the tide turned, and the current began to flow against them. They could gauge their progress against the land, and at times they seemed to advance only by inches or even to be standing still. To hoist sail was unthinkable. They could only row. The Caird still had its full quota of 4 oars, but the docker and the Wills had been reduced to 3 apiece. The temperature had fallen, perhaps 15 degrees since the change of wind, and now hovered around 5 degrees. The spray, combined with the snow, to freeze into a mushy coating over the insides of the boats, and on the heads and shoulders of the men. During the loading of the stores, Greenstreet had given his mittens to Clark to hold, but then in the hurry to get away while the tide was favourable, Clark had gone off in the caird, leaving Greenstreet in the docker, with nothing to protect his hands as he rowed. Now his hands began to freeze. Frostbite blisters developed in his palms, and the water in them also froze. The blisters became like hard pebbles inserted into his flesh. Somewhat after 1 o'clock, when they had covered half the distance to the new camp, they came to a towering rock protruding from the water about 1/4 mile offshore. The caird, with Wild at the tiller, and the Wills under the command of Crean, made the obvious decision to pass inland of the rock. But Worsley, acting on one of his unpredictable impulses, elected to pass outside of it. The Wills and the caird struggled on toward the beach, but the docker was lost from sight. By going to seaward of the rock, she had ventured too far offshore and been caught by the full violence of the wind. Here the surface of the water was torn into foam, and the wave-tops were ripped off and blown downwind. Worsley knew at once that he had acted unwisely, and he swung the docker back toward the coast. "Put your backs into it!" he shouted at the rowers. But it was almost all the oarsmen could do to hold their own against the wind, and it was now doubtful how much longer they could do even that. Worsley suddenly jumped up and shouted for Greenstreet to take the tiller. Then he took over Greenstreet's oar. Worsley was fresh, and he set a tremendous pace. Somehow Macklin and Kerr on the other oars managed to keep up, and slowly, foot by foot, they pulled their way closer to the rock, and finally reached it. They had gained a lee, only to be caught in the surge of the seas against the rock. "Back water! Back water!" Worsley screamed. They held her off, but only barely. 3 times the docker was lifted up and hurled toward the rock, but then the wind eased down momentarily, and they were able to pull clear. Greenstreet resumed his oar, and they continued toward the land. In the midst of the struggle, the mitten on Macklin's right hand had slipped off, and he saw now that his exposed fingers were turning white with frostbite. But he dared not stop rowing, even long enough to cover them. By now it was after 3 o'clock. The caird and the Wills had landed safely. 2 seals found lying on the beach had been killed and stripped of blubber to start a fire. Shackleton stood looking out across the storm-driven sea for a glimpse of the docker. Finally, around a point of land, a speck appeared through the grey mists. It was the docker, toiling into the wind toward the beach. It looked as if she was going to make it, when suddenly another blast tore down from the cliffs. Worsley again took over Greenstreet's place, and this time old MacLeod put out the stump of a broken oar and added its feeble pulling power to the others. It made a difference, though, just enough to gain the reefs. Worsley quickly grabbed the tiller and guided her through the rocks. The moment her bow touched, Greenstreet swung his numbed feet over the side and hobbled ashore through the surf. He spied the vapour rising from the freshly killed seals, stumbled toward where they lay, and thrust his frozen hands into their blood-warm bowels. Chapter 2. Once more, they were all on land and safe. But the wondrous joy that had marked the landing only 30 hours before was absent now. They realized, as one man said, that Elephant Island had flattered only to deceive. She had revealed her true face to them, and the sight of it was ugly. Moreover, an examination of the new campsite raised serious doubts about whether it had been worth the trouble to move. It was a rocky spit about 30 yards across, extending to seaward like a tongue stuck out from an enormous glacier 150 yards inland. The spit rose steeply from the water, and its upper reaches appeared to be above the high water mark. But otherwise, it was completely naked. Except at the shoreline, there was not a boulder or even a small rock that might protect a man from the wind. "A more inhospitable place could scarcely be imagined," wrote Macklin. "The gusts increased in violence and became so strong that we could hardly walk against them, and there was not a lee or a scrap of shelter anywhere." As the forecastle hands were setting up number 4 tent, The wind got under it and ripped a 4-foot rent in its threadbare material. A few minutes later, number 5, the old hoop tent, was caught by a blast of wind that very nearly tore it to shreds.